There's been a lot said in the past few weeks about the ongoing and powerful effects of colonisation on Māori. The government-appointed Safe and Effective Justice Advisory Group came out with the He Waka Roimata Vessel of Tears report with a call in it to change a criminal justice system that's, quote, clearly not working. Māori is 16% of our population but comprise 51% of the prison muster. At the 220 meetings in Hui around the country, there were many reports of generational trauma with Māori trapped inside a justice system foisted on them. The solution being urged on us isn't new. It's to seek repair from within iwi, hapu and whānau. Māori should be leading their own justice initiatives. And recently, Stuff decided to see if much had changed in New Zealand since the movie Once Were Warriors brought us a brutal depiction of life behind closed doors in the family of Jake the Mus. And the conclusions, there's more disclosure these days, there's progress in various areas, but our problems are the same. Poverty, domestic violence, too many children in state care, sizable drug and alcohol abuse. Alan Duff, of course, wrote Once Were Warriors, and he's just published his new book, A Conversation with My Country. Alan Duff, good morning.
Good morning. You were listened to back then, back at the start, before anybody knew you. The reviews for the first books that you wrote were lyrical, and you had your trenchant critics, but you had many admirers, and you'd peeled the band-aids off the wounds in our society. And how did you become persona non grata, do you think, in certain circles?
I think I became persona non grata, first of all, to the academics who had got themselves nicely entrenched into positions of political correctness. I've got a theory, and it's only that I've always been pro-business, and I don't mean pro-horrible corporate vampire-sucking, you know. I'm pro-business. I always look at a restaurant and think, you know, I wish them all the best. Anybody who's working hard at self-employment, I've got a lot of time for that. And the left, I think, have little empathy for the self-employed and for people who are trying to help themselves.
So you're talking about people maybe in the employ of government departments, university or whatever, universities, all hooey no dooey. I think I find that phrase somewhere in your book. That's the kind of person who you think is again, Alan Duff.
I think so, and I have been taken by surprise. I've been invited to events, and then I found that it was that they had a stage walkout, you know, that was all planned. And it just seemed odd to me.
You've maybe lost cachet because of the media reports of you going bankrupt while in France and living in a chateau and leaving investors in the lurch. Do you agree that it's done you a certain amount of harm in the public mind?
I'm in no doubt that it's done me harm, but even the word that you use, investors, there were no investors. There were creditors. The great bulk of them were finance, second-tier finance companies, who in turn themselves collapsed owing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. But it was straight out business failure on my part. It was doing property developments that were architecturally designed and having a virtually all Māori team of builders. And so my management skills got quickly exposed. And then the bills mounted and, I looked at it and thought, my God, I've blown this. Kim Hill interviewed me, and I heard after she sort of signed off with me, and then she said, that was Alan Duff living in a chateau in France. It was an expat Kiwi mate who called me, and he said, you're in the headlines. Why don't you come and live in France for a little while, and you look after my chateau? And that's exactly what I and my wife did. And another very close friend gave me money. I had literally $1,000 to my name. I pulled my house out of the family trust, so that was up for a mortgagee sale. I literally left with nothing, but I can't change public perception. I just keep on at what I'm doing and try to be an honourable person.
The reason I mention that is because you've got a book out, which we want to get discussed. And I suppose it calls into question how many people are listening to you now. You talk a lot in the book about talking to Kiwis and getting feedback through the years. What's the impression you get about how many people are listening to Alan Duff now?
I don't want to sound vain about it, but everywhere I go, people say nothing but really positive things.
You are a whetstone on which others can sharpen their own opinions, it says on the cover of this book. And their opinions of you have always been sharp, and the knives have actually always been out to a certain extent, yeah?
They say the knives have been out for me, but I think there's a whole lot more rousing cheers for me than there are knives wanting to be stuck into me. I think the people that are against me are definitely in a tiny minority.
Getting to the book, and I mentioned the latest reports before you came on, that Māori should be fixing Māori problems, among other things. You're saying the same thing, aren't you?
I've been saying the same thing for 29 years.
You have chapters on welfare, prisons, education. Welfare first. We have to stop blaming Māori for the problems in society, you say, making the point that welfare for impoverished Māori costs the country far less than the welfare by another name we dole out to Pākehā people with money. Can you expand a bit on that?
Well, I think, for example, the bailout of South Canterbury Finance, that was just, it was just unbelievable. It was, people went in with a clear mind that they were investing in something that was at risk, and the government took away all that risk from them and gave them, you know, paid out 1.7, 1.6 billion, whatever it was. And the original settlements were only 1.3 billion, and yet there was a whole lot of talk that somehow the iwis had been overpaid. And I just thought it was, I think it's hypocrisy. I think there's a whole lot of people that are claiming, their accountants tell them how to claim the, you know, whatever tax benefits working for families are, and they've got $10 and $20 million farms, or they've got, you know, they've got extensive business interests, and they're white, they're not brown.
I suppose governments don't get re-elected if they neglect the investment worries and anxieties of the middle class of New Zealand.
And that's the reason why we won't get welfare reform. There are political realities out there that we all have to acknowledge.
So you're in sympathy with Māori on that point. Let's talk about prison, and you've been incarcerated yourself as a young man in Borstal. Māori culture won't stop the march of the doomed, you write in this book. What will, if Māori culture won't, which is the thrust at the moment, with great hopes for it stopping the march of the doomed, as you put it, what will stop it then?
Well, look, I'm friendly with Calvin Davis, and I'm not knocking his genuine, sincere attempts with the $93 million Tikanga Māori program in prisons. But I did say to him, I don't believe for one moment that it will work, and he told me that he believes that it will. They're not there because they are lacking in Tikanga Māori. The Tikanga Māori would help, but they're there first and foremost because of bad parenting, abused childhoods, and being knocked from pillar to post. That's why they're there. So we have to address what their problems are. We've got to give them $5,000-$10,000 when they get out so they can pay their rent in advance, pay their bond, instead of us fretting, oh yeah, but what if they go on the booze? It's madness that we spend $120,000 a year to incarcerate somebody, and yet we give him $300 when he walks out those prison gates. It is sheer madness. You're just inviting the person to come back into as a yet another recidivist and cost the country another $120,000 a year because you want to save a lousy $5,000 or $10,000 by giving him a bit of a head start or a bit of a kick start.
It's the optics of that again. That wouldn't look good if someone that the public doesn't like gets out of jail and gets $10,000.
I think the public sometimes have to be told that they've got it wrong in this case, because it's a case of you either pay the $10,000 or you pay the $120 per year to keep them inside.
Let's talk more about that. Māori are streets ahead of where they were and once were warriors, if you look at them based on the book and the film, although it was always a cohort of Māori, and you made that clear. But in wealth and entrepreneurialism and representation in government and so on, and you praise that in this book. Some issues out of that. First, Māori were always great entrepreneurs, trading with New South Wales until Governor Gray shut that down early in our history. And they're proving to be great entrepreneurs again. So with that purpose and with that cleverness and with that pride, where is the progress at the bottom end of Māori society? Do you see it?
I personally wouldn't focus on the bottom end. I think we have to put that in the too hard basket. It's just going to take effort and money out of all proportion to its sort of immediate cost. But I would concentrate on the, as we've been doing for the last 25 years at our Duffy Books and Homes program, focus on the kids and give them books and give them nothing but encouraging messages. I would try and outshout the voices of negativity, like blaming fast food outlets on Māori and Pacifica obesity. It's just a nonsense. It isn't the fast food operators. It's us, of our own volition, walking in through the door and ordering fast food that is responsible for our obesity. It is our lack of education, and it is our lack of reverence for the concept of education. And I'm talking about that demographic that aren't advancing at all. But on the positive side, we've got vastly higher numbers of university graduates. We've got vastly higher numbers of entrepreneurs.
But that demographic, not confined to Māoridom, causes a lot of the problems in society, which are often blamed on post-colonial trauma. And you write about that as well, because they have an outsized effect on domestic violence, on violence generally, on crime, and on the way we feel about living in New Zealand. What do you think of the post-colonial generations of trauma argument?
How many years are we going to use that excuse? How many years? Another 25, another 50, another 100? How long do we keep saying post-colonialism did this to us before we look in the mirror and say, it doesn't matter what made us like this, what's going to unmake me like this? It is so simple.
There is a dimension to this, though. Te Wharepora Hau, which is a wahine collective, took you to task online a couple of years ago because you were citing brutalised people like the Chinese at the hands of the Japanese, or Hungary being invaded countless times by hordes of foreigners and so on. Their point was that the difference with Māori is that the peoples you cite all had their land returned to them in the end and were able to reconnect with that land and recover their spirit and culture and language, whereas Māori do not and cannot.
Well, again, it's not true. And the various regimes that invaded Hungary, for example, they didn't get the land returned to them. Even now, right in 2019, it's not as if, you know, all of the Hungarian populace are landowners. To the contrary, they are not. All I'm saying is that every society has had its turn of being colonised. You're sort of giving us a reason not to change the message, and I just don't agree with it.
You yourself have had trauma, though. I mean, not intergenerational trauma like that, but the legacy of your own violent mother has had a profound effect on you, a lingering effect. So trauma does linger. I mean, trauma has been the fire, arguably, underneath your books, hasn't it?
Well, but surely, I mean, I couldn't agree more, but surely I'm a living example of using the trauma and turning it into positive things. All of those experiences and Once the Warriors and all of those characters, at some stage or other in my life, I had either lived it or witnessed it or inflicted it or being an inmate, doesn't matter what, but everything was turned into a positive. And that's all I'm saying. I'm not pointing the finger at them. I'm not hectoring. This is our 25th anniversary this year and our 13 millionth book.
But you're tough. You are a singularly tough and resilient individual. Not everybody reacts to setbacks and succeeds through them the way you have been able to.
It doesn't matter what, you know, whether I'm tough or whether I was lucky I got born with writing genes, and I certainly did get lucky that way. But it doesn't matter what level your intelligence is at, it still seems to me a pretty simple solution. You can either wallow in this or there is another way.
You yourself acknowledge the colonial legacy. You agree that some iwi were swindled way back when, of
Absolutely, 100%.
You cite the shameful neglect of the Māori soldiers who fought in the World Wars, who came back not to acclaim but to sing Pākehā servicemen given farms. You agree with the spiritual dispossession that occurred with migration to urban settings, etc. So your eyes see what others see, including the Māori Renaissance, but somehow mashed up in your response is still this once were warriors thesis that there is this incorrigible seam of violence, like contaminated earth exposed. If that's how it is, it does have a half-life. It will work its way out of society. So how far away are we from that?
I've seen remarkable changes, and that's what's, I think, a good part of the thrust of this book is on those positive changes that I've seen happen.
Alan Duff is talking to us, a conversation with my country. Are you surprising people? You've changed your mind about certain aspects, haven't you?
Yes, I apologise.
You've kind of got on board with the Renaissance.
No, I don't call it the Renaissance. It's too rich a word. It is a revival, and I'm happy to call it a revival and delighted that it's a revival. I love my Māori people. Why wouldn't I?
Because you were perennially accused by people like Ranganui Walker, but others as well, as being part of the problem, not part of the solution. And I remember Tariana Turia talking about how Māori weren't just once warriors. You know, they were all sorts of wonderful things that Māori did, and the soft and gentle side and so on. So, but you were always regarded in the minds of some that you were always part of the problem, looking at the dark side, not the bright side.
Well, Ranganui Walker, and, you know, I don't want to disrespect his family, the late Ranganui Walker, but he had a real thing about me. And but I just thought, well, you know, you don't come from the real world. You are way less related to the Māori world than what I am. You don't come from that real world. You're a university professor. You just went from high school to university and then went on working for a university. What relevance has he got to the demographic that we're talking about? What relevance did he ever have, or anyone like him have to the world of once were warriors? Zero. They've never even seen. And quite frankly, over the years, having visited hundreds of schools, decile one and two and three schools throughout the country, I've never seen hide nor hair of any of these people with their grand theories and their endless laments about colonialism and its terrible effects on us. If they're so concerned, why haven't they been there supporting our Books and Homes program? Why has the literary establishment been completely silent on what we've achieved? Do they think 13 million books is not enough? Well, how many books did they put into these poor communities? They didn't. They didn't put a single one into the poorer communities. I don't even think they've got a right to be pontificating on the issues.
Tariana Turia, when she was talking about you, also talked about, because I want to know where once were warriors, that violence came from. And God knows it's been talked about enough, but she mentioned that violence against women in Māori society was very whānau regulated and not tolerated. Women could desert unkind husbands and take refuge with the tribe. So now we have, of course, women's refuges. How did those mechanisms disappear? Because Māori, that cohort would seem to be strangers in a strange land of Pākehā justice and social services, which is being talked about again.
In the book, I quote, I forget the woman's name, but she was kidnapped as a 5-year-old Pākehā woman, I think in the 1840s. She had two marriages, both to wonderful Māori men, and she said they never laid a hand on her. And I quote that in my book, So that people know we weren't like that. And I agree with Tariana on that. They did not scold their children. They let them run free, and they included them in conversations. I also quote that. Mm. I just think we lost something along the way. Again, my theory is when they were talking about us as a race, as a doomed race in the early 1900s, I think things went downhill from there and never quite recovered. But now that we've got, the revival, the cultural revival, it's just a miracle. We're just witnessing a miracle.
Okay. But that cultural revival involves reviving, you know, whakapapa, tikanga, wairua, tapu, Māori, mana, all those words you hear quite a bit. And that is our public path, to have those amplified and not discounted. So you're agreeing with that, aren't you?
as I said earlier, I'm agreeing with whatever works. I'm not saying that I agree with all of the teachings that they've got, but it's none of my business. I can't go in and say, oh, you shouldn't be teaching that, but you should be teaching that. It's not my place to say that. But as I've said to my Pākehā detractors or antagonists, you white liberals are advocating that our children go back to learning our traditional stick games, et cetera, sitting cross-legged on the ground, playing in the dust, whilst you are teaching your children computer skills and how to code, and you're teaching them they've got financial literacy and they know exactly how to go about getting a mortgage.
But hang on, those white liberals and the brown liberals too, they just don't advocate that we teach Māori children poi and kapa haka. They're very keen on getting them in front of screens and becoming part of the digital age, in fairness.
I've not seen hide nor hair of any of them at any Decile 1 school in the country. And we have got 98% of the Decile 1 schools in New Zealand on our program. I haven't seen hide nor hair of them. I don't know what you're talking about there, Jim.
Well, I was a Books and Homes ambassador on your behalf, not that I was illustrious in your ranks. And I remember going into a couple of those Decile 1 schools, and probably at that stage they didn't migrate the computers into them, but they have since, haven't they? I mean, there's a lot of assistance for that kind of learning in New Zealand classrooms.
Yes,
now,
from the Education Ministry, I'm sure. I just wish that the academics would come down from the ivory towers and go out into these Decile 1 schools and say to them, you know what, there are these places called universities, and they can change your entire life.
You get stuck into the Children's Commissioner, Andrew Beecroft, for saying that all roads lead back to poverty and material disadvantage. And in the course of that, you say you can take the boy out of the ghetto, but you can't take the ghetto out of the boy. But this comes right after your observation that certain neighbourhoods produce bad outcomes. So can it be both? I mean, you can take the boy out of the ghetto and the ghetto out of the boy, can't you?
You can. That was just a general statement. I wasn't having a go at Judge Beecroft on a personal level. I'm sure he's a fine man with, you know, great intentions. But
yes.
I was just telling him to don't you decide on my behalf, on my children's or my grandchildren's behalf, that somehow we're going to find the new dawning with whānau, hapū and iwi, because you're certainly not living like that yourselves. If it's such a successful model, why do white people not adopt it for themselves? Why are white people not forming themselves into whānau, hapū and iwi? It's very strange, that, isn't it?
A lot of white people miss not being part of a whānau. They
miss it, but they
life.
Don't go out and create it themselves, do they? Because they know damn well it doesn't work. They know damn well they're not going to get into their house, not even in Ponsonby, but let's go beyond Ponsonby, but they're not going to get into their middle-class house if they're living in that sort of a conceptual world. They can't.
Poverty is not pulling this cart. The cart's wheels have fallen off, you say. And the people in it, in the carts, are left rotting body and soul. And it's a vivid metaphor. But what does it mean? What is pulling that cart then? We know that people are in the cart. What is pulling the poverty cart if it's not poverty?
Legions of sorry excuse mongers who tell people that your state will never ever improve. They don't tell them that, you know what? Use the Main Freight slogan. Education is the enemy of poverty. That's the message they should be drumming into them.
But they are. They are drumming that message in.
Again, I beg to differ on that. They're not. It's not coming from a, and certainly not from the apologist lot. Not for a moment. They're not. They are saying that, you know, we need to increase their welfare payments. We've got to give them dignity and all that sort of thing. They should not be saying that. They shouldn't be saying to us, we're entitled to our state houses. They should be giving us the means to get out of the state house and into our own housing.
Look, I know Api Rananata all those years ago famously warned against welfare. And not just, he was talking about Māori, but it just doesn't apply to Māori. But these are really tricky problems, because if you then remove the welfare, as you often get, you know, people sternly suggesting around about election time, what happens? You can't just take the welfare away.
No, and I was never advocating that anyway. Not that, that's just heartless. That's sort of straight out of Republican America. I'm not into that. The political reality is it has to be reformed slowly and quietly, if that's possible. And I think the only way to do that is through training programs that incentivize them. I don't think there are enough incentives. As I've suggested in the book, I don't think the average taxpaying citizen would mind one iota if you gave $500 supermarket vouchers to somebody who can show that they've lost 20 kgs of weight. You know, the way you empower people to change is to allow them to do it themselves, but you've still got to incentivize them.
Educational achievement, you cite 2017 NZQA figures as kind of the truth that dare not speak its name, as it were. Fix education for Māori and you will fix Māori problems. Of course, education takes generations and, well, how long do you think it takes to repair that damage?
I think a problem takes as long to repair as from the moment you decide that it's got to be repaired. That's how long it takes. I'm not again Māori. To the contrary, I think they've made remarkable progress. And I've said, I think they're the most successful colonised Indigenous people in history.
When you say they, how Māori is your worldview? It seems these days to be pretty Māori, but you just used they. I'm not trying to trip you up, but to what extent do you identify with...
Yeah, I think that's just being a bit pedantic, Jim. But I have said almost from day one, I'm not going to be defined as to who I am, what I am, by any Māori cultural expert or by any Pākehā white liberal or anyone else. I'll define who and what I am on my own terms, and I'll stand in front of the firing squad and I'll still be saying I can be who I want to be. Even though I played rugby and I love rugby like every other Kiwi rugby fanatic, I'm also big on books. Every one of my Māori relations that I see, you know, quite often, is not big on books. And I don't mean my immediate family. I mean, you know, when I go back home to Rotorua and go to my old rugby club rooms, I know that they're not readers. And that's not the conversation I prefer, where it doesn't have reference to a book. Say I went to a kapa haka, they're not going to be giving me that conversation.
No, but if you went to a Morris dancing convention, you wouldn't get the book chat either.
Yeah, precisely. And I think no one has ever says, oh, are you being Pākehā? Are you really being Pākehā if you're a vegan? It's just nonsense.
Look, in the time left, you say we need to change the conversation, which is a variation on we need to have a conversation, etc. And phrases like this can be as vague as the phrases pertaining to the legacy of colonialism that you mistrust. What does it mean in concrete terms from here on in? And you talk a bit about this at the end of the book, but I'd just like, you know, to tell us, what does it mean? What are the concrete things we can do to move ahead and move swiftly ahead and solve some of these problems that we've discussed?
We've got to change the language. And the language just says, all right, why are so many Māori in prison? Because a bad parenting. And then people say, oh, there's Alan Duff putting down his people again. But all of the Pākehā prison inmates are also there because they got bad parents.
Mm.
It is just a fact around the world. People who have bad parenting, abusive childhoods, tend to end up in prison or creating social mayhem somewhere. And by conversation being changed, I mean change the language. Don't call it what it is. And if you call it what it is, then you can start the change. And all of the conversations all of the columns that have been written in the white middle class magazines like Metro and North and South and The Listener, I don't know of any Māori that reads those magazines. They're having a conversation about us, to us, and at us, but it's not including us. And they're all white people awarding themselves, patting themselves on the back for what they did for people that don't have any idea that they even exist, because they haven't read a single word that has been written about them.
So we can end as part of the solution, not the problem.
I also took away from the book that, in fact, you're optimistic. You think we're going to work through this.
Oh, I think we're going to be a truly great little nation. Yeah.
Alan Duff, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.